Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
One of the great stories involving the aftermath of World War II is how so many Nazis and Nazi perpetrators of the Holocaust escaped from Germany, escaped from the hands of, or he totally evaded capture by the Allied forces, and ultimately wound up elsewhere in the world and had, many of them, quite rewarding lives until they died natural deaths rather late in long lives. Though they had escaped, were later apprehended. A famous case of that sort, of course, is Adolf Eichmann. Perhaps another is Franz Stangl, not as well known. We'll talk about those two cases and about the whole system of the transmission of derelict and really guilty Nazi perpetrators into the outer world. My guest, into the world where they could not be apprehended and could not be properly punished. My guest is Gerald Steinacher, a young Austrian historian who these days is located at, he's just taken a job, in fact, at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln. He's done many interesting volumes relating to, in general, the history of World War II, the history of Nazism and fascism. And his new book is titled Nazis on the Run, How Hitler's Henchmen Fled Justice. How many of Hitler's henchmen got away?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer. We don't have exact numbers, and it depends very much on the definition. If you look on Germans and Austrian perpetrators, Nazis, war criminals, then the numbers are rather small. For example, in Argentina, maybe 300. But if you're going to include also collaborators, SS members from all over Europe, especially Ukrainians, but also fascists from Croatia and other countries in Europe, then, of course, the numbers are much, much higher, and you have 10,000s of people who got away after 45.
And there seems to have been an escape, sort of an underground railroad, as we said in the Civil War, for slaves who got out of the South and came north and were helped to get away from the South. There was an underground railroad of a sort heading south from Germany. A particular location of great importance was the South Tyrol, which actually is a German-speaking sector of Italy.
Yes, so the South Tyrolean region in the Dolomites, Lake Garda.
Yeah.
Many people probably know this area from tourism, from skiing maybe, was, I call it, a Nazi loophole. It was the way out to Italy. And Italy was a kind of Reichsautobahn, an autobahn for war criminals after 45, between 1946 and 1950, actually.
And the basic way to do it, the way most of the people you write about got out, was to get false papers which enabled them to go to other countries. And those false papers were essentially received from the International Committee of the Red Cross, the ICRO.
Yeah, the International Red Cross was kind of a dilemma, because at the end of the war you had millions of refugees in Europe, and for many refugees the Allies would say, well, we are not responsible, especially for ethnic Germans. So the Red Cross would jump in and did issue these ethnic Germans, but other refugee groups, travel documents, but without any checking of their background and so whatever. So many war criminals.
All they needed was two people to vouch for them.
Yes. So let's say you have a group of three SS officers.
Yes.
At the end, all of them have a perfect valid Red Cross travel document. No problem whatsoever.
One such case in point was Adolf Eichmann, the best known of those people. How did he get... Where was he before he escaped from Germany?
You know, there's a popular assumption that people did flee from Europe in 45, but nobody got out in 45.
He fled later.
Eichmann didn't get out of Europe in 45. He was in Germany, first in a prisoner of war camp, and then he was hiding with various farmers under different names and aliases. And in 1950, 5 years
as
after...
As late as
1950... Yeah. With the beginning of the war in Korea and the Cold War becoming hot, he went to Italy, got a Red Cross travel document there, and moved to Argentina.
Now, did he another very important institution, you say in the book, and you evidence this in many ways, you demonstrate it in many ways, was the Catholic Church, and particularly the Vatican, which seems to have played a large role in assisting these Nazis on the run Why and how?
Well, parts of the Catholic Church were very anti-communist. This is very important to keep in mind, especially in Italy. There was a strong communist party, a strong partisan communist movement.
In the post-war years.
In the post-war years. And the Catholic Church, parts of the Catholic Church, were frightened, terrorized by the idea that there would be a communist takeover in Italy. And the Americans too, by the way, and the CIA, of course. So there was readiness to help anti-communists. And former SS officers were clearly one thing. They were anti-communist.
There were some particular ecclesiastical figures. There's one bishop who seems to have played a very large role. What's his name?
Alois Hudal.
Hudal.
He was an Austrian bishop.
Yeah.
And this is also a very good example that it's not only anti-communism. In his case, it was clearly
He was a Nazi.
He was a Nazi bishop.
Yeah.
So you can, that's no doubt. And there were others.
Isn't he the one who wrote a book reconciling Catholicism with Nazism?
Yes. In 1937, he wrote a book as a Catholic bishop, The Foundations of National Socialism.
Uh-huh.
And in this book, he explained to the world what National Socialism means as a Catholic bishop.
And sent the book to Hitler.
And sent the book to Hitler
or
with
may or may
his
not
dedication,
have read it.
Dedication to Hitler, yeah.
Yeah. What about the rest? What about the Pope and the Pope's role in this, if he had any role at all?
Well, again, we have to see this.
This is Pius the
12th. Yeah. It is very clear, and this is not a surprise, and that's nothing new, really. We know this. Pius the 12th was one of the very first Cold War warriors. Long before the Americans joined in the Cold War, the Catholic Church, especially in Italy, did already, you know, fight communism in his way. So there was a certain sympathy for people in Eastern Europe, for former SS members, collaborators, anti-communists, especially if these people had a Catholic background. So a former SS member with Catholic background and, of course, anti-communist, could gain some favors and could hope for help in Catholic circles.
Now, of course, with regard to Pius the 12th, there's long been a considerable controversy as to whether he chose not to do what he could have done once the fact of the Holocaust has become very clear. But yet another point that's sometimes made about him and made critically is that he was pro-German and thus, in a sense, pro-Nazi. And one evidence of that, or one basis for that, is that he was deeply invested in German culture. He had been the papal nuncio to the Weimar Republic before he got back into Vatican politics, where he ultimately became the Secretary of State, so to speak, of the Vatican before he was elevated to the papacy. But he was pro-German and deeply invested in German affairs. Thus, there might have been some sympathy for these Nazis on the run.
Well, there is no doubt about that he was very pro-German. He loved German culture, Kultur, and he would like to speak German and so on. He had good memories on his time in Munich. But I think the main enemy was communism. And the second enemy was National Socialism, the Third Reich, the Nazis. And in 1945, the Nazis were gone. The only enemy left were the communists. I think that's the idea a little bit behind all this. And you are right. He was very pro-German. And this is an important factor when it comes to the ethnic Germans and helping ethnic Germans who were expelled, who then at the end of the war are in Italy as refugees. And among these refugees are people like Eichmann, Josef Mengele, and other major perpetrators and war criminals.
But here are two other interesting figures, both of whom were good Nazis in their time, and one of them at least was surely a perpetrator, and one was not, but played a very important role in the German war machine. I have in mind Klaus Barbie and Werner von Braun. And they got out and to the West, but not through the route that we're talking about. Instead, they were essentially brought out and rewarded by the government of the United States. Why and how that happened is something we need to talk about, which we will do as we continue, right after we pause for these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Our guest during the first part of the program tonight is Gerald Steinacher, who is the author of a very significant compendious book titled Nazis on the Run, How Hitler's Henchmen Fled Justice. And that is published by Oxford University Press, which testifies to the significance of the volume. Though this is actually translated from the German.
Yes, it's translated from the German.
Before we come to Werner von Braun and Klaus Barbie, let's talk just a moment about you. You are an Austrian.
Yep.
By identity and by birth and largely by education, though you're now essentially transmuted into being an American.
Well, I lived in Italy for many years, so yeah. I'm a little bit Italian too, Northern Italian at least, a little bit South Tyrolean. And
now you're an American academic.
Yes. I moved to the U.S. in 2006, worked at the Holocaust Museum first in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. then in Harvard as a research fellow. And now I'm in Nebraska and teaching Holocaust history.
At the University of Nebraska in Lincoln, yes. where, as I told you, my brother was a member of the faculty for many years before he left to join a think tank in Washington.
It's a small world.
Yes, indeed. How did you come to, you're deeply invested in Holocaust studies. How did you come to it?
Well, I know I was always interested in history. I was 6 years old when I told my parents I want to become a historian.
Uh-huh.
And there was always a special interest in contemporary history. And I'm sure it has to do with my Austrian background, because as you all probably know, the Austrians had a hard time in coming, to in terms with their past. And only in the last 20 years, things changed. Germany is far more ahead of Austria in kind of dealing with this kind of Nazi history and responsibility. And I think this kind of coined me and shaped me, especially the Wehrmacht Ausstellung, the exhibition on the crimes of the Wehrmacht when I was a young student at the University of Innsbruck. Hmm. I realized that there is still so much to do and there is a certain responsibility I have.
Now, back to the question I raised just a moment ago. Many were helped out secretly, surreptitiously, through the routes that we were talking about earlier. But others were, in fact, picked up, wined and dined, so to speak, and brought either to the Western world, to the United States, or, for that matter, to the Eastern world, to Moscow, and other scientific precincts in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, it was clearly a result of the Cold War. I mean, Germany was destroyed, the industry was destroyed, but the minds were still there. And the victorious powers wanted, of course, use these people, these experts, especially in the military field, like people like Werner von Braun, rocket scientists, but also other people, and also people from the intelligence field. And once the Cold War started, the Western, but also the Eastern, victorious powers, the Soviets, were interested to hire these people for intelligence purposes. And
so were we. This fellow Klaus Barbie, whom I mentioned, was hired essentially by the CIA, was he not?
Yeah, I don't call it hired. I call it recycled.
Recycled.
These people were recycled for the early Cold War.
Say a word or two about Barbie. He had some responsibility for killing lots of people.
Yeah, he was the commander of the Gestapo in Lyon, in southern France, and was wanted for war crimes from the French, also very much so. And the Americans, the CIC, the counterintelligence corps, hired him. They were in desperate need of anti-communists. The OSS, the wartime secret service, didn't exist anymore in 1946. And suddenly in 1947, a Cold War broke out. And so Klaus Barbie was used as an expert for fighting the communists in France and also in Western Germany, of course, by the Americans.
Where did he actually locate? Where was he in Washington?
He was working in Germany, in Augsburg.
In Germany?
Yeah, in Augsburg.
But he was wanted by the French?
He was wanted by the French. He was
and eventually the French. They got him, didn't they?
Eventually they got him, but first the Americans, you know, when they realized, okay, this is really a hot potato, we have to get rid of him, they used the route we just discussed with the Red Cross travel papers, Italy, to bring him to Bolivia, to South America, where he got a new identity and where he lived for quite many years as a weapons dealer, also making money with selling weapons.
Yet a few years ago, there was a famous trial, I guess in Paris, of Klaus Barbie, and much of France was deeply invested in that trial. He was convicted. He's serving prison time at the moment, isn't he? Unless he's dead.
He's dead. He died. But the important thing with Klaus Barbie also was in France that the whole wartime history, especially Vichy, the history of collaboration in France, became a topic. Similar importance, a little bit less maybe, but similar importance like the Eichmann trial in Jerusalem in 61, 50 years ago, when Eichmann was actually found and then brought to justice in Israel.
How many people of that sort did we grab up for intelligence functions and or for scientific contributions?
For intelligence functions, certainly hundreds. There was a few years ago, the National Archives and the CIA established an interagency working group, Commission of Historians, to investigate this problem and this issue. And there are hundreds of documents and files now released and accessible to the public at the National Archives in Washington, D.C.
A question that has become increasingly pertinent with regard to escaped Nazis, escaped perpetrators, is, isn't it time, finally, to end the search? Shimon Wiesenthal is long since gone to his rewards, though there is a foundation in his name based in Los Angeles, and supposedly there are still Nazi hunters.
And now in Vienna.
And then there is, what's the name of the couple in France who are so busy in these matters?
Klarsfeld.
Yeah. Isn't it time to just kind of call it quits? If there are any left, they're old, doddering men in their 90s, and they're going to be dead in a year or two.
Well, I'm a little bit selfish here because I'm an historian, and for an historian it's very important because we have evidence. Every court trial produces material, produces witnesses, produces very important material historians can use for future research.
You're not so much interested in punishing the surviving Nazis. You're interested in finding out more about them.
Yes, it's about the truth. It's not about punishment.
Mm-hmm. Well, what truths have emerged for you in the work that you did for the book Nazis on the Run?
Well, I learned many, very many lessons, and I don't think we have the time to talk about all of the lessons I learned. But one thing is very important to me, I think, that this issue is still going on. The research just started, especially the afterlife of Nazis. And we did so much research in the last years about everything that happened before 45, but what about after 45? And we're just starting to dig up these histories, so to speak, and this is still very much an open topic.
One thing that interests me in that regard, as a matter of fact, is the significant number of Nazi Party members, whether they were also perpetrators involved in the Holocaust one way or another, one would have to examine more closely. But Nazis who wound up back in German government and in Austrian government after the war.
Yeah, also this is a very important point. I mean, when we talk about escape of Nazis and war criminals, perpetrators of the Holocaust and so on, it must be said that most of these people, most of the perpetrators, most of the Nazis never left Europe. Uh-huh. This is a very important point. There was a popular assumption, well, especially in Austria and in Germany, all the Nazis and all the criminals went to South America or somewhere. But, of course, this is not true.
Were most of them not even prosecuted?
Most of them were not prosecuted, yeah.
Why not?
It has to do, again, the Cold War background explains a lot. There were many efforts in the immediate post-war years in 45, 46, 47, 48, especially from the U.S. Americans, very much so. Nuremberg, for example, is of course, a famous case. But the moment the Cold War kicked in and became hot, especially in 1950, these efforts kind of died away. And the Cold War became much more important, and the other things kind of much less important.
Well, so, how were these Nazis in the post-war period, how were they used in the Cold War? What services did they render?
Well, it's just give you an example, German army. The moment the Cold War gets hot, you need the German army.
Mm-hmm.
Again, in the East, in East Germany, the Soviets, but also in the West and Western Germany. Two German armies. And this means you use these officers again and you have to stop persecuting them. It's very clear. There's no doubt about that. So this history or this past has to be a closed chapter.
The first major government in West Germany, before the unification, in the immediate years following World War II, was, of course, the Adenauer government, Der Alte. He was quite significant, wasn't he, as a figure in German political life. And he had loads of former Nazis in his government. They weren't running armies, though maybe some of them were in the defense ministry, but they were in his cabinet and in the sub-cabinet positions. Wasn't his foreign minister a former Nazi?
I mean, the thing with these former Nazis, I mean, there are also practical reasons. When I stated the example with the army, West German army, you just needed these experts. Where do you have? You cannot start from the scratch. There were many people in the Nazi party, in the private industry too, everywhere, on all levels. You cannot exclude all these people from society. Otherwise, there is no way to start a new
state. Of
course,
one has to make a distinction. They may have been members of the Nazi party. It doesn't follow that they were perpetrators in the Holocaust, though you might argue that everybody who was in Nazi life had some sense of what was happening in the Holocaust and thus was at least a passive participant.
That's true. But, you know, the general climate was after 1950. 1950, with the beginning of the Korean War, the war in Korea, this is also clear from my book, the escape from perpetrator stops in 1950. 1950, 1951, nobody leaves Germany, Austria, Europe anymore. There is no need for that anymore. There is no denazification anymore. The climate changed. There's the wind of the Cold War. And there's not interest anymore in persecuting these people.
Here's an interesting career. There was a fellow who was a member of the Nazi Party and was a German officer in the Balkans during the war, who wound up as the president of Austria. Though first he served as the Secretary General of the United Nations.
Yes, Kurt Waldheim. Dr. Kurt Waldheim. Famous case. And actually, Waldheim at the end served Austria very well, his country very well, because his case helped Austria, especially young Austrians, in coming to terms with their own Nazi past.
How so?
Because Waldheim became an international, scandal, I would say, an international affair. And Austria was forced to face its own past, its own Nazi history and the Anschluss and all these things. Because for many years it was considered a victim. The first victim of aggression.
When international criticism was directed at Waldheim when he was president of Austria, didn't Austria essentially rise to his defense?
Part of it. But the young generation, critical, myself, and this was really the turning point in Austrian history.
We might look at some other cases. I'm very fascinated by one particular figure. We've mentioned his name, but we haven't really examined it yet, though I talked about him and with Gita Sarinyi many years ago. She investigated Franz Stangl, and we might turn to that, he being the man who ran one of the extermination centers. We are directly back to Gerald Steinacher after we go to the WGN newsroom and to Paula Cooper.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Gerald Steinacher, professor of history at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, and author of a number of works, the most recent, Nazis on the Run, How Hitler's Henchmen Fled Justice. Oxford University Press are the publishers. I raised the question of Franz Stangl. It's a very interesting case. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but at least a quick overview, including how he got out and how he was pulled back in, so to speak.
Yeah, Franz Stangl was an Austrian. He was already in the euthanasia program and then was transferred to Treblinka extermination camp, became the commander. And at the end of the war, he was in hiding in Austria and finally heard about this underground railroad system, this route through Italy, and Bishop Alois Hudal.
And the man we mentioned earlier.
The famous Nazi bishop in Rome. Stangl went to Rome. He crossed, of course, first to Italy and went to South Tyrol, became a new identity. And then he met Hudal in Rome, and Hudal helped him with a new travel document from the International Red Cross. The interesting thing is that the name was not really changed. Stangl, his name is Franz, but in the document his name is Paul. Paul Stangl. Not much changed.
This was the guy who ran the camp, which had sort of the perfect record of efficient exterminations. How many were killed at Treblinka while he was in command?
More than 100,000, 300,000.
I saw an estimate something like 800,000.
Yeah, 800,000. Yeah. That's probably correct. Yeah. So he
I
was.
I would say that's a serious war criminal.
Yes. Well, I would say he's a perpetrator of the Holocaust.
Of course.
Yeah. Clearly, there is no doubt about that. And it's also well documented how he got out, who helped him, and that the bishop and this Vatican Commission for Refugees was clearly involved in his escape. Then he made it to Brazil. He was working in Brazil. First he was in Syria, then he went to Brazil. He worked in a factory, and in the 1970s he was extradited to Germany and sentenced.
And spent the rest of his life in prison.
Spent the rest of his life in prison. He was interviewed by Gita Sereny, famous historian, famous interviews with him, the perpetrator von Stangl. And soon after the interviews were finished, he died in prison, yeah.
And those interviews address, because Sereny is a very, very sensitive interviewer, thinker, writer, and those interviews and her writing about them address the question of how could essentially sort of an ordinary man, the very same question that Christopher Browning has raised, how do ordinary men come to do such inhuman things, such barbarous things? How do they come to accept the role of commanding killing factories?
Yeah, Stangl was certainly one of the first cases where this question was, you know, out there, and it's still one of the questions that really, you know, troubles us. How is it possible?
Yes.
And after Browning's work and others, it's quite clear that it's ordinary men. It's not extreme sick people who are doing this or who are capable to do these kind of crimes and genocides, but it's ordinary people in certain circumstances, and that's really frightening.
Were the top Nazi hierarchy ordinary men? Is Hitler an ordinary man? Is Goebbels and Goering and so on, are they ordinary men?
The people in Nuremberg.
Heinrich Himmler?
The people in Nuremberg who were convicted at Nuremberg, most of them were ordinary, but even more intelligent than average people. They were not sick. They were not, you know, had no craziness or no...
What's your estimation of Hitler? That is, how does one account for Hitler?
Well, that's a very tough question.
It is
that's a very tough question, yeah. You know, I would say he was an ordinary man, in a way. And this is really frightening, because he did such extraordinary evil.
Well, how do ordinary men come to do such extraordinary evil?
And in certain circumstances, it's possible, and it's the lesson we learn every single day from the genocides that's going on right now in many places on this world. It's not ending, and sadly, probably it will not end anytime soon. And it's very important to see that some of these perpetrators, at least, will have to face justice. I think this is a message we should send out there. Maybe it takes 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. But one day in Rwanda or in Congo or wherever it is, one day some of these people at least have to stand trial.
One last aspect that we haven't discussed at all, but which is very well developed in your book, Nazis on the Run, is the various perpetrator types who got into another part of the world and were valued there for the special services they could render. They got into the Arab nations, Egypt and Syria particularly.
Yeah, this is something people normally completely forget about it. They think about Argentina. Argentina kind of is the bad nation, the poor, you know, Juan Perón is to blame for, and so on and so on. But this is a little bit too complicated. It was the favorite destination, but also Syria and Egypt were very prominent destinations. These countries were interested in experts in the military, especially experts helping the military to fight Israel.
And some of them had fine anti-Semitic credentials as well.
Yeah.
Some of them were propagandists rather than military.
Some of them were from the propaganda. Some of them were Nazi doctors, like Aribert Heim in Egypt. We still don't know if he really died there. Probably he died there. And some of them were perpetrators of the Holocaust. And some of them were military experts.
And I suppose some of them are still there, though they would be very aged persons by now.
Well, you never know. I give you the example of Erich Priebke. Erich Priebke is in his late 90s now. He's still living in Rome. He's convicted war criminals under house arrest, but every single day he drives around with his Vespa. So some of these people get very old.
Mm-hmm. You're concerned, you were expressing this to me off the air. Let's quickly say something about it on the air. You're concerned with the recurring or renascent fascism, which is showing up in Europe again.
Yes, I'm very concerned about the situation in Europe in a couple of countries, especially in Italy, but also in Hungary. And these cases are completely overlooked. You know, people always focus on Germany and Austria, but these are now democracies who are really working very well. And we should look at cases in other places like Hungary and Italy, where fascism is on vogue and in government. In
what form is fascism taking, say, in Hungary? And to what degree is it dominant, if at all?
It's in government right now after the last election, and it's kind of a renaissance of the old fascist regime that was allied with Hitler during the war.
The regime of Admiral Horthy.
Of Horthy, and then later Szalasi,
yeah,
who was responsible or co-responsible for the deportation of the Hungarian Jews in 1944-45. As the last Jewish community in Europe still intact was deported by the Hungarian government, of course, yeah, and the Germans occupying that country.
Why and how does fascism rise again? It doesn't take the name of Nazism, it just takes the name of fascism, does it?
Yeah, I think the National Socialism, fascism was unique, so it was, you know, one time, but different forms, of course, yeah, are possible nowadays. And I think it has to do with not dealing with the past, not coming to terms with the past. No Vergangenheitsbewältigung, that's a German term for it. And Germany, I think, learned the lesson, and Germany did a very good job. The Austrians, in the last 20 years at least, also. But some nations, you know, still struggling with that. And the case of Italy is a very prominent one. Mussolini came to power in 1922. So Mussolini was Hitler's teacher. People forget about this a little bit. Yeah, and sure. Hungary and other countries, they didn't really treat their past really, and they have to come to terms with it.
All that you've said, certainly, verifies and underlines the significance of an historical approach to these matters, Holocaust history, and beyond that, the history of fascism and Nazism. I thank you so much for joining us tonight. The new book by Gerald Steinacher, that name, by the way, is spelled Stein, Steinacher, and the new book that we've been drawing from is titled Nazis on the Run.